Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and today's guest is David Heinemeier Hansen, founder and CTO of 37 Signals, better known for the products Basecamp, Hey.com, and since recently, Campfire. David is the inventor of Ruby on Rails, won the 24-hour race of Le Mans, which is very impressive, and enjoys his life as he likes because 37 Signals was built as a bootstrap company 20 plus years now. Congratulations on that. And besides selling secondaries to none other than Jeff Bezos, the company is fully in the hand of David and his co-founder Jason Fried, which is, I think, something we need to talk about because it's so different from most of the company stories and venture stories that we hear out there. So, David, welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the first question that I had in mind, because you bootstrapped for 20 plus years and you saw so many other companies raising lots of money, and it always sounds so crazy, it sounds so cool. How did you resist raising venture, and why wasn't it relevant to you?
Both Jason and I were born in this world of startups at a time of great exuberance in the late 90s, when the dot-com boom first really was going crazy, was when we got started working. I worked for a number of startups in Denmark that were funded by VCs, and I saw how that turned out once the dot-com bust happened. And it really wasn't pretty. And I think it gave both Jason and I kind of a vaccine against that kind of business building, because we had seen it firsthand what happens to companies who take a ton of money before they have revenues, and how ugly it is when that goes sour. And it usually does, right? The math of venture capital is that a very small minority will end up paying for the rest. But that means a very large majority ends up going bust. And a large share of those go bust in really uncomfortable, terrible ways. And I saw some of that firsthand and thought, like, you know what? I'm not interested in building that kind of business. There must be a different way to build a software business. And of course there is. Most businesses in this world, in the history of commerce, were not built as venture capital funded businesses where they were constantly raising more money and they had to be in these extreme growth rates right from the word go in order to make it to the end. So we built a software business by bootstrapping it off a consulting business, which I think is still a viable, great strategy that plenty of others have followed. Again, no strategy will guarantee you success, but there are certainly differences in how bad the strategies play out when it doesn't work, which again is most of the time. Most businesses will fail, even the ones that are bootstrapped, even the ones that are bootstrapped off consulting revenues. And I think that's an instructive case to look at, because if Basecamp, for example, had failed, that was our first kind of big launch, what would have happened? Nothing. We would have learned a bunch of stuff launching a product. We would still have complete control of our destiny. We would just keep working with clients for a bit longer. And then maybe we'd try a second product. Maybe we'd try a third product. Maybe we'd try 10 products before we found one that really worked and were able to get us to where we wanted to go, which was ultimately to convert this consulting business into a software business. And that opportunity to have as many tries as it takes without leaving you destitute is, in my opinion, a really appealing one. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone should be starting consultancies in order to do product businesses. And there's many different roads to get there. But that was the road we followed. And I think it is important to look at it in its contrast to the VC racing model, especially when it comes to risk. There's this general sentiment that to be an entrepreneur, you have to be a huge risk taker. And I think it's actually wrong. I think a lot of really good business people actually hate risk. I don't like risk at all. Sometimes you take a calculated risk and you go like, oh, okay, I've triangulated everything here and that makes sense. But a lot of times you look, how can I eliminate the risk? How can I make it so that we can take a bet on something without betting the company, for example? And that's something we've done for over 20 years. We've taken all sorts of bets. There's no guarantees in business. You don't really know what customers want until you put the product in front of them and ask for their credit card, especially in software. But you can do it in a way where if it doesn't work, you're still fine.
It's so interesting because I think a lot of founders should ask themselves more and more the question, do I want to bootstrap? Do I want to raise venture? But as so many stories, and I'm guilty as well, I'm a media company with the podcast, I'm interviewing a lot of venture-backed founders, and you hear more often about them than the bootstrap stories, it feels like, oh, if I want to be a complete entrepreneur in quotation marks, I have to raise venture. And I often try to talk founders out of raising venture, and I'm like, hey, why do you need it and do you really need it? So asking you, because I know that you're good friends with a lot of venture-backed founders as well, and you've seen also some stories like Shopify play out super well, who would you recommend raising venture, and who would you say, hey, please think about it twice?
I'd say venture is a great path if you're in a winner-take-all market that needs to be captured immediately or it's going to close. So I think the traditional examples of that are things like eBay or Facebook or Twitter, social media, anything that has substantial network effects, and where those network effects are going to be super difficult to catch up to if you're not already in a leading position. Those are the kind of businesses where venture really gives you an advantage, I think, where you have to be speculative, where you see that the potential market could be enormous and we have to run incredibly fast to get there. That's the whole blitzscale thing. I don't think it matters if you're building tools. If it doesn't, if there's not a strong network effect that, for example, Basecamp, the tools that we built, or even, hey, our email service, they're both of a quality where if a company chooses to run their project management on Basecamp, it doesn't really matter if someone else uses, I don't know, Microsoft Project or Asana or Trello or any of the many other alternatives that are out there. It doesn't take anything away from them. Versus if you're the first one to some new social media and there's like 1,000 people on it, it's not very useful, right? Social media networks follow Metcalfe's law, where the value of the network increases exponentially with each added node. That's not true for a project management tool. Like the customers we have, if we get 10x as many customers, like they don't get that much value out of it. There are some network effects. There's some familiarity. People can switch between companies and, oh, I already know Basecamp. So it's not that there aren't benefits to it, but the benefits are just in a completely different category than if you're dealing with network effect businesses. Now, sometimes it's not always obvious. Like, is Shopify a network effect company? I don't know. I want to ask Toby that, actually. Do you think it's a network effect company? I would probably say I don't think so. But there are secondary network effects, which are things like integrations and ecosystem network effects that can be important to look at, even if the thing itself doesn't have strong network effects. But if you are in that tool building space, and a lot of SaaS is that, it's selling tools to individual companies where the network effects are just secondary at best. You don't need venture. If you can build a better Basecamp, you can start tomorrow and you can start getting customers. Like, they show up fresh in a way they wouldn't once they've signed up, for example, for X. Like, if you build a big following on X, you're oftentimes one of the last person to be interested in changing to another social network. I think that's why everything from Mastodon to Threads, even Threads, I think, is a great example. Like, they have literally unlimited money, unlimited promotion. It's still not that easy. Oh, and they have the tailwind that a ton of people hate Elon Musk like he's the Antichrist. Even with all of that, you can't just go like, whoop, jump over what's already there. But when it comes to tooling and other kind of non-network effect stuff, that is possible. So to me, that's the big fork in the road. Are you building a network business? Are you not? Some are in the gray areas in the middle, but others, it's quite clear whether it's one or the other.
I would also say, and probably that sometimes falls into the network effect category as well, but is also not as obvious in the beginning. If you're building fintech infrastructure, for example, in the European market, and you know the European market quite well because you're from Denmark, if you do this in Germany, it costs like a lot of money until you can really start building something, and you can't really earn it by consulting before. So there can be businesses that have a lot of costs up front, but it's not most of the companies, even when you think that.
No, I think that's a good example. If there are actual barriers of entries, or you're building the kind of software company, internet company that also have a large physical component. I mean, Uber is a network company, for example, but let's say it wasn't. Let's say people didn't care whether it was one or the other. If you'd still have to seed your market by paying drivers up front for not driving or other areas in that regard where you need a large amount of capital, yes. That's why when I share our story, I'm keen to stress that we're building software, internet software, low marginal costs, no upfront investment beyond the development itself, which, by the way, can't be substantial. This is one of the reasons why I encourage bootstrap founders to, well, not just encourage, I'd say it's actually a blocker. You have to be able to build it yourself. And this is the other thing. I meet a lot of folks who have ideas about how to build a software business, but they don't know how to build software themselves. Well, you're going to need to either be have a rich uncle or to have a successful exit earlier in your career or to raise venture capital. Because if you need to pay other people's salaries before you can even do anything, yeah, that's going to be difficult to do in a purely bootstrapped environment. So bootstrap is and probably always will remain to some extent a niche path. But a niche path that could fit tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of businesses through it.
Do you think, like, let's say I'm a non-technical founder, which I am if I would build a software company right now, I would be the non-technical one. Do you think it gets better due to all the artificial intelligence and all the stuff that I can use right now that I might be able to still build it on a low-cost basis and could bootstrap it as well, even when I'm not the one building all the code?
It's a good question. I think generally productivity does really matter. This is one of the reasons we built most of our own software that we use to directly build our stuff. Like Ruby on Rails sprung out of the needs of a bootstrap business. That we had one technical person when we were developing Basecamp, and that was me. I had to have an incredible amount of productivity available to me. So I had to have the most productive tools. And in my optics, that was the Ruby programming language, and then I built my own tooling that was Rails, and those two things combined to give us like the unfair advantage, if you will, over companies who at the time were using, well, I was going to say at the time, it's actually gotten worse since, but many of the mainstream environments require you to have very large teams, especially if you want to do native development. I've been using a AI pair programmer for quite a long time now. I really like it. It is a productivity booster. I don't see it as a game changer yet. Like, I can't tell my AI pair programmer, hey, build Basecamp. Oh, no, that's quite not what I wanted. Can you change a few things? We're not at that level yet. It's entirely possible we'll get there, but it's also entirely possible that a lot of things would happen. Everyone thought it was entirely possible in 2017 that by the end of that year, all cars would be driving themselves. That was not what happened. It may still happen. It may still happen that all cars won't be driving themselves in maybe even the relative new future or near future. If you've looked, obviously anyone who've observed the advances in AI, it's incredibly difficult to predict just the pace of evolution. When will it get to the tipping point where it's so good that you go like, hey, if I was an illustrator right now, I'd be a little worried if that was my livelihood, because I'd look at the AI stuff and go like, you know what? It's actually really good at a bunch of things that fall squarely within my domain. Doesn't mean there won't be any human illustrators left, but maybe we need fewer of them. It's so difficult to predict. What is clear today, though, I think that's that. Then you don't need any prediction. You can just look at what is. AI is not going to enable the non-technical founder to build an entire startup by themselves.
Fair enough. And sometimes good to hear for the people that are technical founders and therefore have an advantage with that. Sad to hear for people like me who think maybe I have some.
Well, maybe you just need to wait 18 that. Months, right? I mean, maybe, given how fast all this is going, it may entirely change. But I'd also say, given how fast this is going, you could also predict another future, which is that AI is just going to write everyone their own software. Just like soon it seems like everyone can get a movie of their choice made by a prompt. Oh, what I'd like to see tonight. Can you create a 92-minute movie with these five components in it? I think it is entirely possible that AI is going to deliver software to the masses in the same way Excel spreadsheets did. Excel is perhaps the most successful software platform of all time. It has enabled final end users to create databases and all sorts of advanced modeling software and a bunch of things where they did not even need neither software developers nor another company. So it's also speculative, which is why I think it's just a fun time to be in the business, because there's so much uncertainty that even like, what is 2026 going to look like? It's entirely possible it's not at all different from what it is right now. And it's entirely possible that the whole world has been turned upside down. I love it.
I wonder how many people listened right now and were like, wait a minute, I never thought about Excel being a software platform. I guess
so. Yeah, I think that is, I mean, that is the long-term dream and overstated, overhyped dream as I've seen it for a long time. People realize, oh, Excel actually is a software development platform. What if we made building web applications that simple? I've seen at least, what, three generations of no-code tooling in my time, and they've all been kind of bullshit, because the reason why Excel works is it's such a bounded domain. Like, it can do these things, and within that, it's really good. You're not going to use Excel to build Basecamp. Like, that's a nonsensical term. And that's where a bunch of the no-code stuff had gone, right? Like, oh, no. Actually, we can take the Excel model, and we can just make it generic. It can build any kind of software. Well, yeah, the problem is, once you get into building that kind of software, you actually, oftentimes at least, you care about all the decisions that turn out to be programming. So I think the ultimate no-code tool, actually, I think no-code is a misnomer. It's always going to be code. The question is who's going to write the code and on whose direction. I see it as entirely possible that who's going to write the code of the future is going to be AI. They're still going to write code. It still needs to be executed on silicon. But the code is going to be written potentially at the direction of someone who does not understand the code, but can have an interaction with an AI that hones in on that code. But again, we're back to science fiction. Science fiction, we can squint and see the possibility of, but science fiction nonetheless.
Let's go back to a bit more of the hard facts about building a company, especially bootstrapping it. Bootstrapping a company means running profitable, means avoiding cost traps, while venture-backed companies can just run through them and be like, hey, we currently have enough money. Let's just not optimize for the most efficient way. Just run through them. Of course, by now, more of the venture-backed companies have to be more efficient, so they could be a bit more aligned with the bootstrap company by now. But out of the last 20-plus years, what would you say are the biggest cost traps that startups and founders run into?
Well, the one you're going to start with right away is the biggest line item in almost every startup is headcount. And the problem with venture capital, if you will, when it comes to cost, is that you are rewarded, nay, you are required to spend all the money you raised more or less as quickly as possible. In most traditional cycles, you raise a ton of money and then you have 18 months to blow it, right? You spend the 18 months to get to the next growth target where you will raise money again. That's how the sort of ladder goes for pre-seed, seed, series A, series B, da-da-da-da, all the way to exit. And when you have that large pressure to spend potentially tens of millions of dollars very, very quickly, the fastest way to spend it is to hire a lot of people. Because that's also how the kind of wisdom goes. Like, if we want to grow faster, we need more people and so forth. Now, the problem is that software doesn't yield to those kind of economics. In fact, they often counter yield to that. One of the most famous tomes on software development is The Mythical Man Month by Fred Brooks. And he has the wonderful quote in there that what one programmer can build in 1 month, two programmers can build in 2 months. There's not a linear relationship between the number of programmers you have and how fast you can build desirable software. In fact, there's often a reverse or relationship. Another way to put it, I think he also mentions in that book, is it takes a woman 9 months to create a baby. you can't hire 9 women and get 1 baby in 1 month, right? Like, there's a gestation period here that I will apply to software that goes sort of similar. If you have if one programmer could build a prototype in 1 month or in 3 months, you can't just have 3 times as many programmers and then make it in 1 month. It just doesn't work like that. So that's one of those fundamental incompatibilities, I think, between what venture-backed companies are trying to do and what software is capable of delivering. What are the inherent constraints when you deal with software? They are of this nature that arriving at, first of all, figuring out what kind of software we want. It's a very difficult process. We've been building software for, 60 plus years now in its modern incarnation. No one has cracked it. No one has cracked, how do we even find out what we want? And if anything, the larger the piece of software, the larger the project is, the more likely it is to fail. The more ambitious it is, the more likely it is to fail, which is why so many of the venture cap or back companies fail very quickly, because they're trying to build large software products very quickly. That's how they can get a moat in parts. And software doesn't want to be built like that. The best complicated systems all started from simple systems. You can't start with a complicated system and have any good success rate to it. That's why so many large complicated systems, when they're kicked off, this is something we often see in Europe and also elsewhere, large government systems that have large budgets, they're always over budget, they're always over time, and very often they end up being canceled. So software is a difficult species when it comes to this. And the headcount is the main ingredients, the main lever that startup companies have to turn on. Now, that has always been true. It's been true right from the word go. But what is more recently true is that you can now also spend an unfathomable amount of money on your cloud. And this has been one of the things I've been interested in. We've spent an unfathomable amount of money on cloud over the years. And I just have different incentives. The way we run our business is Jason and I get to share what's left over when we paid all our expenses from the revenue we take in. It's a very simple model. Like, if we take in $10 million worth of revenue and we spend $6 million on expenses, we get to keep $4 million. If I can improve those expenses such that we only spend $5 million instead of $6 million, I get to share another $1 million with Jason. You don't have that skin in the game when you're dealing with a venture-backed company. In fact, you have the opposite, right? Like, the whole goal is to spend all the money you raised in 18 months, and you don't get to keep any of it if you don't. Like, the whole idea of keeping the money is only something for battle times, right? Which we are in right now, that is fair to state, right? 2-3 years ago, it was exactly the opposite. It was the go-go days, and it had been the go-go days for 12 years. So you had several generations of startup founders who had just been trained that the best thing you can do when you run a startup is to spend as much money as quickly as possible, all on the altar of juicing those growth rates, because growth is the only thing that matters. No one gives a damn whether you're profitable or not profitable, how much money you're losing, what your burn rate is. If you can post those high growth numbers, you will get to raise more money. Now, times have changed. And now more companies have found, like, oh, actually, we can't just raise fantastical sums on back of the envelope presentations. Like, now there actually has to be revenue, and there has to be unit economics that at least seem plausible, and preferably even maybe there has to be profits at some point such that you can last longer. So it's interesting how these things are converging. For 12 years, we were in highly divergent paths. Bootstrap companies always had, like, hey, if I save more money, I get to keep the money. Venture-backed companies were always on, like, what do you mean save money? Spend all of it, spend it faster, spend it bigger. And now we're sort of, actually, bootstraps stay where they are. They never waver. We get to keep the money. The venture-backed companies are coming back towards bootstrap. But that's a temporary condition. I think it's important to realize. As soon as the go-go days start back up, which usually inevitably they will forget all about sort of solid economics in a near-term sense and just go like, well, wouldn't you rather want a small slice of a very big pie? That's how it's usually sold.
I think the important question as a bootstrap founder or someone who wants to grow efficiently and wants to be profitable, even when you raise venture, is okay, obviously you have some money left at the end of the year, I'd say, for you and Jason. And the question is finding the optimum between how much money are we able to have as a profit end of the year versus how much money do we invest or spend inside the organization to make it as great as possible. Great meaning the best compilation of all the different sorts of things you have to do to run a successful company. So when do you, or how is your assessment of hey, do we hire someone else? Don't we hire someone else? Do we invest in, let's say, marketing or all the other things? Like, how do you assess costs and new hires, for example?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I'll start with the fundamental premise of how do you make a great company? And how do you define that greatness? What I've found time and again is that there are lots of companies that make for a great 20-person company, a great 40-person company, a horrible 500-person company. And startups very often fall into that. The reason they were able to hire 500 people was because that initial small group was really effective, really had some good ideas, really attracted attention either from investors and usually from investors because they attracted attention from the market. Because they just made something good, right? And then they went, wow, yes, now let's hire a bunch of more people. And they managed to take a company that actually was a great company and turn it into a really shitty one. And it happens just time and again. This is the fundamental disease of bigness. And what's also interesting there is that there are lots of companies whose trajectory in terms of productivity is negative when they add people. This goes back to, as we were talking about, the fundamentals of software development, that what one programmer can do in 1 month, two programmers can do in 2 months, 500 programmers can do in 3 years, right? The heuristic we've followed since the beginning is hire when it hurts. And when it hurts is defined as it should be painful not to have this person. There should be obvious things that are missing, broken, burdening others. It's not speculative. And this is what most venture capital hiring is driven on. Very speculative. Ooh, if we hire another 20 engineers, we could probably come up with a bunch of features for them to implement. And that will probably create a more attractive product, which will probably generate more revenue. There's a lot of probables in there. And only one of them have to go sour for the whole thing not to be true. And that happens just time and again, that you actually end up making the product worse by adding more to it. This is one of the reasons why we historically have never been really afraid of not only venture-backed companies, but also large companies. Because the kind of software that a large company assigns 200 engineers or a venture-backed company that assigns 200 engineers to the problem will produce is just categorically different from the kind of software that 5 people will produce or 10 people will produce. And we produce that kind of software. We produce the 5 to 10 people kind of stuff. And that just ends up being very different. And customers react to it very differently. The number one reason people state over and over again why they love Basecamp is because it is so simple to understand that they don't need any training on it. If you look at a lot of competitors that we now have, for a long time, Basecamp was in this odd position that it didn't attract any competition. These days, it has tons of competition. Virtually all of it, it's very complicated software by this point. Usually what happens is some competitor enters the market. They have a really novel, interesting approach, perhaps, and it's simple to use, and people are attracted to it. Then they attract the funding, they hire the people, and you give it 2 or 3 years, and it just got features coming out the ears, coming out the wazoo, because that's what the 200 new people did. They had to do something, right? They had to juice it. I think a great example that we looked at recently was Slack. I don't know if anyone has gone through the config pages of Slack recently. They're hundreds of little check marks, all representing little enterprise deals that needed that esoteric feature to be present in order to be closed. And then the whole thing just grows 1,000 warts. That doesn't mean that there isn't still a good product underneath all of that junk somewhere. I think there is. I think Slack is a great product, and that's why it had success. But it's also true that now that it has that many people working on it, it just expands and it grows and goes further and gets more complicated. And we introduced a new chat tool called Campfire, which was built by one of those tiny teams, right? Like we had, for a long time, we had two programmers on it. And then at the end, we sprinted a little bit and added a couple more. But it's just, it results in fundamentally different software. And it therefore attracts, to some extent, a fundamentally different customer. So hire when it hurts has to me been the way we temper ambition, that actually the business should be in front of us. We shouldn't be in front of the business. And this is requires some mentality change. Usually when you think invest, you think, well, I got to be in front of the business. I am investing in the future. I often don't see that working out. It's not how we run our business. We try to get the business to run ahead of us, and then we have to hire to catch up with the business rather than try to drag the business to catch up with us because we've done a bunch of hiring.
For everybody who's not too familiar with your company, how many people are you in the company, in the organization, and how many products are you currently building?
We have 68 people right now. We've been swinging from high 40s to, I think we got up to like low 80s at one point. And we're dealing with, first of all, a large suite of heritage products, as I like to call them, that we've been building for 20 years. We have maybe 7 of those. They don't see new feature development, but they do see maintenance and continued service to existing customers. This is one of the weird things that we do. We like to not evict customers. Google, of course, is famous for evicting customers every 5 seconds whenever they change their direction or a new VP is hired, and they shut down some service. And so are startups. There was a good example of this recently. What was it? Notion just bought some company. And then the company goes out and says like, hey, yay, we got acquired. And pop the champagne on Twitter and spray it all around. And then the customer's like, oh, cool, you got acquired? That sounds awesome. What's going to happen to us? And the company was like, well, you got 6 months to pack your shit and get the fuck out of here. You're like, wait. I'm not sure that champagne was for us. Maybe that champagne was for you and your investors, but it certainly wasn't for users. So I've just kind of grown allergic to that, both from large companies like Google that constantly seems to do this, but also from startups, either because they pivot, that's the positive, right? And doesn't mean you can't change direction. Sometimes it isn't right to change the direction, but there's a certain glibness to it that I think amounts to a little bit of pissing in the pool, right? If you teach customers that they kind of can't trust any SaaS service that they sign up for by continuously burning them with these eviction notices, I think that does kind of pollute the pool for everyone else coming after you. Because now you want to be a startup and you want to convince someone to invest in your, or to invest their time and their data in your SaaS solution. And they'd be like, yeah, I'd like to. Your stuff looks cool. But the last 2 times I did that, the company ended up being acquire hired and everything was shut down in 6 months and it kind of sucked. So we have this notion of until the end of the internet. That's the promise that we're making on our SaaS platforms. That either we're going to keep operating this until the end of the internet or until the last customer turns off the lights. And this has led to some sort of funky, weird, almost pathological cases. Like we have this service we created in 2005, which was a free to-do list service. This was one of the first, back then it was called Ajax applications, like dynamic JavaScript applications. And it was free, again. And we started in 2005. We ran it for a couple of years with new customers. Then we shut it off for new customers, I think maybe 2009. And we've been operating it ever since. And we're still operating it. Last I looked, there were about 1,000 users, which is insane in itself. That after we haven't developed something for like 14 years on a free service, there's still 1,000 people who use that as the main way to track their to-do list. And we're like, yeah, I'm happy that we can keep running it for you. So that's what we're trying to be something else, like insert some credibility into the broader point, maybe extract some of the pollution from the pond so that there are company or customers can at least say, ah, do you know what? There are companies who will do this, that will stand by their products, even if they change their minds, right? We've done this with Basecamp. Our most successful products exists in 3 versions, including a version that we have not developed with new features since 2010 that still has thousands of customers. That's a multi-million dollar SaaS business with happy customers who don't want something else than the thing that they signed up for back then. I kind of wish that we had more of that. We're trying to introduce a little bit of that systemically with our once series of products, which is installable software, where at least if the company gives you the software and you are allowed to install it on your own server, if they go out of business or they change their mind or whatever, then they can't take the software away from you. And I wish there was more of that. We're kind of trying to provoke the industry to at least think about it. So we'll see where that goes.
I think one question that arises when I listen to you, with all the noise out there of how startups work, how businesses work, how everybody, like, what's fancy, what isn't, how did you and Jason find what kind of company you actually want to build?
Yeah, so I think part of it was we had both had such a bad experience working for a number of startups during that .com boom bust cycle that gave us one direction or impulse. Then I at least personally had a number of bosses that I thoroughly disagreed with on a large number of topics. And I found that, you know what, a lot of things I received as established wisdom, as best practices, as things to do, felt bullshit, appeared bullshit, turned out bullshit. And it gave me just a very healthy skepticism over any received wisdom, and gave both Jason and I think, the impulse to go back to first principles. And this is one of those things that in itself has turned into a bit of a buzzword, first principle thinking. Is that now in itself a best practice? I don't know, it gets a little circular at some point. But this idea that we will try things without assuming whether they're going to work or they're not going to work. And some of the things is not going to work. Obviously, a lot of things don't work that you try. But if you peel back enough layers and you get deep enough down in the stack of insights that you approximate something that's like a clean slate and then you start building things up, I think you have a better chance at figuring out, first of all, understanding why the things that work actually do work, and also finding new pieces that could work well. I also just think that's fun. I mean, both Jason and I think of the company as a product in itself. And as a product, it takes iteration, it takes updating, it takes experimentation, it takes all of these approaches to trial and error that a lot of companies don't necessarily think about their own company in that way. They don't think about it as something that continuously have to be product tweaked and rewritten or refactored or what else have you from the software world, metaphors that you can apply. But if you do think about it in that way, and crucially, and this is perhaps actually the key ingredient where the rest makes sense, have the independence to do so, then you can end up in a quite different place. And I actually say, I probably should have started with that, because it's kind of like you see some masters of chef on TV, and they're like doing all this cooking, and then they pull out, oh yeah, and then I spent a little bit of time like creating this gratin, and like that's the key ingredient. That's why it tastes so delicious. Yeah, you kind of kept that off camera. The key ingredient here is independence. You can't do a lot of things that Jason and I have done. You can't experiment in the way that we've done over 20 years if you have to answer to VCs who want to see growth targets in 3 months. It just doesn't lend itself to that kind of dynamic. When you operate like that, when you have these very urgent needs to produce certain numbers, you're going to actually follow the playbook as far as you can, right? You're first going to go to the playbook, the VC software company playbook, Try to see if you can find a chapter on whatever else you're facing and just deploy that. Now, that's going to give you a lot of hard thinking. It may also work. I mean, there's a reason we call it the playbook, because it generally consists of chapters that have worked at least sometime somewhere for someone else. Is it going to work for you? Maybe. But it is a way to start, and it is a way to go quickly, especially if you have to spend a ton of money right away. We never had that, and we had, so we didn't have all the money, but we had all the independence. And I think those are two opposing forces, and you end up, or you can end up, in a place like we have when you have way more independence than you have resources. And it's just a really interesting, different place. And this is, more than anything, why I advocate that people review their options. Because I just want to see interesting, novel, different thinking in this world. And if we're all subject to the same constraints, the same timelines, the same playbook, the same funding model, we're going to get monotone, similar-looking types of innovation. And that's just bad for entrepreneurs. I think it's bad for the world. We're not going to see the variety and diversity of ideas that we otherwise would have seen. I think this is why a lot of our products don't feel, they don't look, they don't taste the same as what comes out of the playbook-based VC model. It's like why we can do things like Until the End of the Internet. It's why we can stay with the SMB market, why we haven't moved up market to enterprise sales. The playbook, as it is for software startups, usually goes, you use SMB as a stepping stone to validate that you have something. And then once you have something, switch the whole thing over to an enterprise sales model where you charge per seat, you have a large sales force, and your entire business is funded by a handful of super accounts. And we never had the interest in that. We never hired a sales force. I don't get on that well with sales as a function of a company. So we routed around that and therefore ended up in this weird, and again, only weird in relation to the VC model, weird place where we can continue to stay with an SMB market that we know, love, and feel part of ourselves.
Why do you think is it that all of the products converge, and what is needed to also bring this novel thinking back into the ecosystem? Because often, or how people often start to learn things is they copy stuff, then they model it, and then they are at a level where they are, okay, now I can find my own way in here. So do you think it's just that a lot of founders are in their first cycle and therefore need to copy and then model and then come up with their novel thinking? Or what is necessary here?
No, I actually think it's the opposite. I think that it's almost like creativity. Most children are born highly creative. I mean, I have three kids of my own, and when I sit down with them to draw or whatever, I'm always astounded by the creativity that they seem to inherently have in them. And then if you look at kids who've then been to school for 15 years, a lot of them will have the creativity beaten out of them. I think it's actually the same with entrepreneurs, that entrepreneurs will have the creativity and the novel insights beaten out of them by the funding model, by the dynamics of VC capital, and then they will end up less likely to produce divergent thinking on paths that aren't compatible with the VC approach after they've been through it the first time. Again, does not mean you can't be creative. It does not mean you can't create successful businesses. It just means that like the lane is a little narrow. I think what you need to create the sort of divergent outcomes is you need different constraints. You need different playbooks. And I think this is why we've ended up being such a outlier in some regards, is because we have those different constraints. And I think a lot of other entrepreneurs, if they were in our shoes and they were sitting with our kinds of constraints, the different kind, they would also have ended up with different kinds of businesses, and we'd also been better off for it. So I think if that speaks to you, then you need to find a different model. The model is going to produce the cookie cutterness in that regard. It's a little bit Hollywood. So Hollywood has really started to just shrink its creativity. It's because there are no creative filmmakers left in Hollywood. I refuse to believe that. It is because the big studios fund one thing and one thing only. continuation of existing IPs, because that is seen as the sure bet. And there's some of that with the venture capital model too, that the kind of founders and models and whatever, they kind of have to fit that shape. When it comes to my little corner of the world, like productivity software, business, B2B, SaaS, it's very much the, as we just talked about, all right, you start with your SMB stuff, you get some market validation, then you use it as a stepping stone, and then you immediately switch over to per seats enterprise sales. And like, yeah, okay, that produces just a certain kind of software. It just does. Those forces are larger and bigger than you. And you can't really fight them. You're going to be cutting against the grain when you do that. So if you want something different, you have to have different constraints. There really is nothing other to say about it. I think Jason and I, if you had inserted us into the Silicon Valley rodeo and applied the venture capital forces on us, we would have produced the same stuff. I think we are less unique as individuals than the systemic approach we took is responsible for our divergent outcomes.
I think you summarize a lot of things that I'm sometimes unhappy with when I look at the European ecosystem, for example, of startups, and that all feels like the same, just X is Y, and you just solve this little problem or this little problem instead of like doing something completely new, completely different. And it's interesting. It feels or resonates a lot with what I thought about the last weeks. And for everybody who wants to be or listen a bit more about creativity and entrepreneurship, the episode before this one that I publish is with Scott Belsky, currently Chief Strategy and Chief Product Officer at Adobe, where we talked about creativity. So therefore, could be a recommendation as well. But until then, we have a few more minutes that we can talk about stuff. Just making a small turn back to what you said earlier when we talked about cost traps. We talked about the cloud, or you talked about the cloud, and that you left the cloud and back to hardware. Just for founders who can't really like grasp why that's a thing, can you give us a rough number on how much money you saved in the first year out of the cloud?
Yeah, so we published an enormous amount of detail on this question exactly because I expected a fair amount of skepticism. And of course, there would be a lot of skepticism because cloud marketing has been exceptionally successful. Probably one of the most successful marketing campaigns in tech that I've witnessed since maybe like everything needs to be Java from the late 90s or something. The idea that the future is cloud and that everything trended towards other people owning the computers you run your software on was just such a pervasive paradigm that when it became clear to us that we had to leave, I knew that we had to bring receipts. There was not enough to just bring like insights. There was not enough to bring ideas. We had to bring receipts, and those receipts had to stem from real action. And the sort of overarching receipts, which was we put out there, was a very conservative back-of-the-envelope calculation that said we were going to save $7 million over 5 years. And we're sort of on track with that. What was it? Last year, a few months later, we could already see, all right, well, $1 million worth of savings in terms of what if we had stayed in the cloud had ticked in. So the idea that we were going to save $7 million over 5 years is a really interesting data point, because there will be entrepreneurs who've been very successful raising money who'd go like, let's chump change. Why are you even wasting your time trying to save $7 million over 5 years? You could have spent that attention as opportunity cost on conquering new markets, gathering new growth, da 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 da. First of all, I don't think these things are in opposition. I think people are vastly overestimating the difficulty that a lot of the cloud exits will entail. A lot of the stuff that we have documented has been how running your or owning your own hardware actually gives you a very similar operating experience to renting hardware from hyperscalers and running it in the cloud. Not in all regards, but in a lot of regards. So it's a false dichotomy in part to say like it's about opportunity cost. And second of all, there will also be entrepreneurs who are just like, well, $7 million over 5 years, I'm not spending anything like that. I'm spending $200 a month on some cloud VMs. Great. If you're at the level where A, you have a unvalidated business, you haven't found product market fit, you're not really spending any material money on cloud, and you have the money to spend on it, continue. Please don't start buying thousands of dollars worth of hardware for a speculative idea that might be bust in 6 months. That's really foolish. So I think that's why cloud still has an absolute place. I would start on cloud probably tomorrow if I did a new venture and I didn't know whether that was going to still be in business 12 months later or not, and until my bills were higher. But our bills, when we did our accounting for 2022, were $3.2 million in yearly cloud spend. Like, that to me is real money. I guess you can get phased by all the billion-dollar companies out there. Like, I don't own a billion-dollar company. For me, like $1 million a year, $1.5 million a year that I get to keep and split with Jason, like, that's real money. Either I can get to just keep that money, or I can spend that money on something I'd rather have than sending large checks to AWS or Google or whatever you use, right? We could spend that money on more people. We could spend that money on all sorts of interesting things, and we really rather would. So it comes back to that discussion about, do you even care about cost? If cost is not a relevant metric to you because you're on a journey of venture capital expenditures, then fine, don't do it. Spend all that VC money until you can raise more. But I think what's been fascinating is that our cloud exit narrative has coincided to somewhat a degree with the general narrative that, oh shit, I can't raise all the money in the world anymore. I can't get the crazy valuations people were getting in the fall of 2021. If I want my company, my startup, to survive longer than the next 6 months, I have to extend my runway. How do I extend my runway? I do it by cutting the cost. What are we spending on? Oh, we're spending on that headcount. Oh, do we need all these people? Probably not. And second, what are we spending on cloud? Oh, shit. Are we spending that much money? If we could somehow find a way to cut it in half like those weirdos over at 30 Seconds have done, maybe our runway is going to be like 30% longer, 40% longer. That may very well be the make it break difference between whether we survive or not. So I think the whole discussion has become far more relevant for former companies. And that's great, because I also think this whole discussion of owning your own hardware is, first of all, a fundamental business lesson. Should you own or should you rent? Like, that's an assessment you should do with all sorts of things. Should I hire someone or should I just pay a consultant? If I pay a consultant, yeah, they're going to charge me a lot more than an employee, but I can also then say, okay, the project is over and we part ways, right? The same thing with hardware. If you need a computer every day for a year, then you should probably buy it, right? At least once you reach a certain scale. If you just need it intermittently or you only need it for spikes, great, rent is a great option. So having just some of those fundamental business discussions about how you spend your money, on what, at what timeline, I think is instructive for all businesses. And I think startups sometimes get to loop around that. And then they become very good at the thing that they do, which is spending money. You can learn to become very good at spending money. And then you somehow don't really understand how you make money, how you get to create value that you can actually capture and keep. That to me is actually the exciting part of a business. I'm not excited about having a $10 million a month burn rate. I'm excited about having profits, money I can keep, which comes back to, again, the kind of outcomes you're looking for. If you are a traditional VC-funded entrepreneur, in most cases, you will never get to keep a dollar of profit from the company. You will make all of your money selling your stake of the company to someone else, who then think that they probably can sell to someone else, and then they will sell to someone else, and maybe the fourth holder of that equity will realize some value in terms of profits. You're very far removed from the fundamental business dynamics of making money. And again, lots of people have gotten very rich on that model. Peace be with it. If that's what you want, great. Not what I wanted.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that's that will let a lot of people think about that a bit more, and I will also link to your articles on a bit more of the decision making and how you did it, because I think you documented it quite well, and I really enjoyed seeing it, even when I'm not in a situation where I can save millions of dollars by leaving the cloud. It was still like, okay, it was a topic that I discussed with one of the Adjust founders who sold their company for $1 billion at some point, but they always rented because they said, hey, our COGS for everybody, costs of goods sold would be too high if we would operate in the cloud because we're an infrastructure business. We're not a typical SaaS business. We could not even do it in the cloud. We would not be a profitable company. So depending on the business model, it can also be an issue to run on the cloud. Different story, but so knowing that this can be an issue, also seeing more and more attention towards it so that people make educated decisions. It's not you don't use the cloud or you shouldn't use the cloud. It's more is the cloud the right thing for what you're planning to do? And if you make educated decisions, nobody will say anything against it. It's just like, as you said, it's very well marketed and just going for it because everybody does. We talked about this quite often in the podcast, is maybe not the way to do so. And one thing that everybody talks about too is you have to be in the US. This was the narrative for a very long time. Now Europe gets a bit more traction and more stories are coming from here. David, you lived in Europe, Denmark for a while. You grew up there. You moved to the US. You moved back to Denmark for 3 years during COVID. And I think for a lot of listeners here, it would be interesting to understand the differences between the two ecosystems. And as you lived and worked from both, what would you say? How do Europe and the US differ?
It's really interesting because I moved to the US in 2005. And I was pretty young. I was 25, is that right, at the time? And which meant that I'd grown up my entire life in Denmark. And that was pretty much all I'd known. Then I moved to the US and at first is awed by this and then lived there for 15 years and developed this sort of sense, oh man, I wish America could be more like Europe. That was the broad strokes of my perception between the two countries, I'd say. And part of it was based on the fact that, I mean, you're growing up in a country like Denmark, which is a bit of a fairy tale country, especially for kids. It's a very open country. It's very safe. You can do all sorts of, you see all the positives of socially democratic welfare state. And then I moved to the US and I saw some of the negative effects of not having that, like there everything from homelessness to wealth inequality and so on and so forth. And it's so easy to get this perception, oh, the US is just doing it all wrong. Europe's got it all figured out. Europe's got the politics figured out. They got the wealth distribution figured out. Yeah, okay, but, and it was the but I kind of figured out once I moved back to Europe, back to Denmark for 3 years, is that all of that niceness does happen within a context of complacency, I'd probably say. A complacency when it comes to legislation, when it comes to business, when it comes to startups, that in the US is just completely different. There is just such a dynamic ecosystem over here. There's such a dynamic group of people who really want to, for want of a more gagging cliche, change the world, right? And we make fun of that. I think especially Europeans make fun of that. Because you know what? Most people don't end up changing the world. But the ones who do, inside of technology, a lot of them live in the United States. Either they're from here or they moved here because this is the place where most of it happens. And we only have to look at what's going on with AI to see that the center of the universe, of the AI universe, is still not only just the US, and but even literally Silicon Valley. And I think moving back to Denmark gave me the appreciation of seeing the other side of it, seeing that missing, seeing the risk tolerance missing, seeing the energy and enthusiasm for world-changing ideas missing, and then seeing what we have instead. I think AI, again, is a good example because the main thing Europe is on the map for, let's put aside the fact that there is actually also interesting AI developments happening in Europe. There's Mistral and there's all sorts of stuff. But the main thing, the headlines, is Brussels. The main contribution to the AI discussion is Brussels making noise about regulations. And you know what? It's not because I'm against regulations at all. I think we dearly need some when it comes to anti-monopoly enforcement, but it's not, it can't be about that first. The order of priorities can't be regulation, this, that, and then somewhere down the line, business formation and innovation. And I think it's one of those lessons that I had to move back to Europe to truly appreciate. I had to move back to Europe to appreciate the fact that the niceness of European societies, as it were and as it is, also under threat and also under stress in some parts, comes with some downsides. That most societies just have inherent trade-offs. That there are no societies who've just figured it all out and just can excel on all the metrics at the same time. And I think Europe, to some extent, is arrogant about it in ways that doesn't only not behoove it, but doesn't benefit. That we, in Europe, and I say that as a proud Dane, continue to be a proud Dane, do ride on the coattails of the United States when it comes to technology. And don't take our own digital sovereignty really seriously. I mean, the main contribution to the web in the last, I don't know how many years, from the EU, has been the fucking cookie banner. I mean, that's just a blight, an absolute terrible mistake on the fabric of the web that is harming people around the world in just constant annoyance and sapped attention for no good reason. Now, there is a beautiful ethics behind that, but those ethics did not translate into actionable, usable, user-improving legislation. And I think this is where I'm starting to lose faith that the EU even has any capacity to fix this. And I think this is where, if you zoom out and you look at the overall economics of the picture, you see, you go back to the beginning of the turn of the millennium, 2000, and you chart sort of economic development, US versus Europe. Europe is just continuing to fall behind. Again, it's not all. Like, economic progress is not the be-all, end-all of everything. I would say plenty of Danes do not envy their American counterparts in wherever they are in the socioeconomic hierarchy and want to swap places. But neither is it true the other way around. And that's okay. Can we let America be America to some extent, and then also let Europe be Europe? And then, like, we'll, at the edges, try to learn from each other without saying, like, well, America needs to become Europe or Europe needs to become America. Yeah, it's become more nuanced, and I've gotten a greater appreciation for the American model and what it gives, even as it's so obvious what it takes.
Yeah, thanks for sharing the perspectives on both sides. If you would steelman the argument for a founder who's currently thinking, do I build in Europe or do I build in the US, what would be the reasons to build in Europe?
I say, if you are bootstrapping and you can internalize the American mindset in terms of startups and world perspective, Europe is a wonderful place to build. I often, and perhaps more so than when I just lived there, would say, like, do you know what? There was nothing that required us to be in the United States to build Basecamp. But if you're looking to raise serious money, go the venture capital route, I do think there's a distinct advantage. I also think there's a distinct advantage if you're in certain subfields. There are these clusters of talent and so forth that if you're looking to very quickly build a large business, do help. Now, I'm mostly on the side that, like, why do you want to do that? Does it have to be really large? Does it have to be really quick? What if you build a great business that only hired when it needed and didn't need it that much to get started? Do you need to be in the U.S. for that? No, I don't think so. So I think it is a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, more than anything, though, I think it's an adoption of a perspective. And it's an adoption of an ambition. And I was surprised to see that during my recent few years in Europe, it was less. Like, there's just something inherent. And maybe it's because all the individual European markets are so small compared to the U.S. and it's so difficult to attack Europe as a integrated market, despite the fact that this is literally why we have the EU, is to have a common internal market. But there are so many little barriers. One example is I've invested in a number of companies, and one of the companies is a system that does time registering for employees, and it needs to integrate with various systems. In the United States, you can integrate with literally like four providers, and you will have covered 150 million employees. In Europe, it's all per country. They all have their little different labor laws, and they all have their little different registrations. It's very difficult to roll out to all of Europe. So it's very difficult to build, I usually don't like that word, but I'm using it nonetheless, scale. Because I do think there is a sense of scale that matters in terms of escape velocity. Can you get to a sustainable business? For a lot of software companies, I mean, this is specifically looking at Denmark, and that is one of the smallest markets in Europe. It's, I mean, just under 6 million people. You can look at other markets that are bigger, and the problem is slightly different. But it's just, it's too small. Like, the kind of size of businesses you can build and the amount of penetration you need in the market to sustain a business like this is so high. In the United States, the market is just incredibly vast. It's hugely receptive to new technology to increase productivity in ways that European businesses just generally aren't. If you're building software, for example, and you just have to sell to non-software businesses, you're going to face a lot more resistance in adoption of technology, generally speaking, than you will find in the United States. So not only is the market smaller in terms of literal number of companies and potential buyers, it's also smaller in the percentage of those buyers who are willing to hear you out. And this is why when I deal with the Danish companies that I've been investing in, we talk about the American market as like the second or the third market. Yes, you should bootstrap on your home market. That just makes things easier. You're still at a slight disadvantage to the companies who bootstrap on the American market that already starts with the biggest software market in the world right off the bat. But you need to get there sooner rather than later. Now, maybe there are arguments for saying that actually in some ways, in some niches, the fact that Europe is such a fragmented and impenetrable market gives you some protectionism. Yes, true, maybe, kind of, but it also then shields you from the international competition that'll get you to be the best, right? I mean, if you can hide away in some obscure market, and I say that, I mean, saying like Germany is an obscure market or France is an obscure market sounds weird, but it is compared to the size of the American market. I see that maybe you're not under the same stress that will arrive at the kind of software that'll conquer the world. Again, does all software have to conquer the world? No, it doesn't. But would Europe be better off if it had more software and service and internet players at the scale of Spotify? Clearly, we would. Clearly, it's a problem for Europe that Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, all of it is in the United States and uses China as its manufacturing base. Like, what's left for Europe? Just to write stupid cookie banner laws? Man, I hope not. I hope there's a broader ambition than that. And I know there is. I met plenty of European entrepreneurs who want something different, want something better. The scale is just very small. And I think you have to accept that. You got to accept starting out that Europe really is 20 years behind. How do you catch up? Do you catch up doing what you've been doing so far? I don't know, man. Doesn't seem like it's working.
I would love to end on this note because then founders can think about what this means for them and their business. So therefore, David, thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts, experiences, etc. And I will link to your blog, LinkedIn, etc. because then everybody can read and dig deeper into what you're talking about there and what you're sharing, linking to your products, etc. because I really enjoyed it. It was a great conversation. Thank you so much for being a part of the Unicorn Bakery.
Thanks for having me on. This is great.